Lacking the control to eat only when hungry, they seemed uniquely vulnerable to the food cues embedded in large portions. Most likely, there have always been people who showed early signs of conditioned hypereating as children. But as stimulating food becomes increasingly available, we're seeing more and more of this behavior, and troubling eating behaviors are becoming apparent at ever younger ages.
Chapter 35. The Culture of Overeating.
The question, is food available, once had social and economic implications. We were really asking, are we facing famine? Can we afford food? That framework has changed in Western societies. Now we usually mean, can I buy food nearby? Can I eat it anywhere? In today's America, the answer to these questions is usually yes. This makes it the ideal laboratory in which to study conditioned hypereating. Our encounters with food are intense, and they are frequent. The number of neighborhood food stores and restaurants grew markedly in the 1980s and beyond, coinciding with increasing rates of obesity. Highly palatable foods are now available any time, day, or night, wherever we may be. Rare is the community that lacks constant access to restaurants, convenience stores, and vending machines. We have drive-through fast food, cars outfitted with cup holders, and gas stations, pharmacies, and even health clubs that sell snacks and other food. But the ready availability of food affects more than our ability to purchase it easily. It also means that we're able to eat it easily, whether it's in our cars or on the run, in social settings, or at work. Social mores once kept us from eating on the street or walking into a colleague's office while munching on popcorn. But we no longer think of that kind of behavior as rude. The barriers have been lowered, Unilever scientist David Mila said to me. These days, most meetings and almost all social occasions are constructed around food. It's always there, said Mila. There is great frequency of coming into contact with places where food is being sold or where other people are eating. Mila, who is based in the Netherlands, was particularly aware of differing patterns in the office. We go to a meeting in America and somebody will inevitably bring in a huge plate of bagels and cream cheese and muffins and all these things. For Europeans, it comes off as bizarre, but it just seems to be expected here. Everybody seems to be expecting that a lot of food will suddenly show up. The contemporary context of our lives makes it possible to eat just about all the time. And many people do. Food availability and the opportunity to consume are ubiquitous, and that has been a huge driver of energy intake for children and adults, Susan Johnson of the University of Colorado told me. A breakdown in meal structure, with the distinction between meals and snacks increasingly blurred, also promotes increased consumption and, ultimately, conditioned hypereating. It becomes a self-perpetuating cycle, with conditioned hypereating spurring a further breakdown in meal structure as out-of-control eaters pursue every opportunity to consume food. Back in the 1950s, people ate meals, said Meredith Luce, a dietitian in private practice in Orlando. They ate them together as a family. Snacks were the sole property of growing children to provide an extra opportunity to nourish the growing body. Adults didn't eat snacks. But snacking is now the norm, and the data show that it, too, rose in the 1980s and 1990s. Worse, snacking generally occurs without a compensating caloric reduction at mealtimes, especially when snacking patterns are erratic. People don't eat smaller breakfasts, lunches, or dinners just because they snack throughout the day. Elsewhere in the world, cultural patterns have tended to reduce the risk of conditioned hypereating. Countless articles, some based on research, some on speculation, have tried to explain the so-called French paradox, the fact that the French generally have lower rates of both cardiovascular disease and obesity than Americans, even though the French diet is higher in fat. One theory suggests that the types of fat the French consume lessen their risk. Another says that drinking red wine with meals does the trick. Still other commentators suggest that the French are healthier because their lives are generally less stressful than those of Americans, or that they have genetically based metabolic differences. none of these theories seem well supported by the facts. A more evidence-based hypothesis is that while the French linger longer over meals, they eat smaller portions. And portion size, we know, helps drive conditioned hypereating. Researchers base their conclusions about portion size on several kinds of analysis. First, they compared serving sizes at restaurants in Paris and Philadelphia and found that American portions averaged 25% larger. That held true both in chain restaurants, such as Pizza Hut and the Hard Rock Cafe, and in comparable bistros, local Chinese restaurants, creperies, and ice cream parlors in each country. Second, they analyzed restaurant reviews in Zagat guides to the two cities and found that reviewers in Philadelphia were far more likely than those in Paris to comment about large portion sizes. Furthermore, all-you-can-eat or buffet options were highlighted in the Philadelphia guide but never once mentioned in the Parisian reviews. Finally, they studied comparable French and American cookbooks. Joy of Cooking and Je sais cuisiner showed a consistent trend. American recipes generally yielded larger servings of meat and soup courses and smaller servings of vegetables. Historically, another protective factor in France has been the tradition of eating two or three structured meals a day in the company of others, with no snacks in between. For a long time, French restaurants wouldn't even serve meals at times other than those they considered conventional lunch and dinner hours. In France, we still have a very strong meal structure. France Belisle, an obesity researcher at the Hotel Dieu Hospital in Paris, told me. "There's a cultural notion that you don't eat between meals," I asked. "That's right. You don't do that. You learn very early on as children that you just don't do that." When she teaches, Belisle often says to her students, "What? You have not brought anything to eat into the classroom? If we were in America, you would have brought your coffee, your donuts, your chocolate bar with you to eat." Not in France. Nobody has given even a fraction of a second to the thought that they could have brought food into the classroom, she said. "They've never done it before, and they're not tempted to do it. There is nothing in the environment that stimulates such inappropriate eating at an inappropriate time." But the norm of eating only at certain times of the day, with its built-in safeguard against overeating, is under siege outside America's borders, even in France, as snacks, fast food restaurants, and other temptations are beginning to emerge. As the availability of hyper-palatable food is exported, it will become more apparent that conditioned hyper-eating does not respect national borders. Jean-Pierre Poulin, who directs the Center for the Studies of Tourism and Hospitality Industries at the University of Toulouse-Lautrec, sees signs of a gradual cultural shift away from notions about proper meals and toward what he calls vagabond feeding. He refers to this as the destructuration of eating habits in France. While vagabond eaters still consume structured meals in a social context, they also eat alone on multiple occasions throughout the day. France Belisle has observed the same trend. Food cues are becoming more and more numerous, more and more present in the French environment, she says. As a consequence, more people are likely to become obese, a pattern that is starting to emerge in the French population, especially among children. As meal patterns break down and the French gain cultural flexibility in when and where they can eat, eating for reward begins to overtake eating for hunger, and satisfaction becomes elusive. The satiety mechanism that takes place between meals cannot take place if you eat constantly, Belisle said. Instead of experiencing the metabolic effects of satiety, you will lose the notion of what they feel like. Although environmental changes in France have so far been less drastic and the weight gain in the population is less extreme than in many other developed countries, the trend is unmistakable. The social framework that supports conditioned hypereating is slowly being erected. Still, America remains in the vanguard. A segment of the population seems especially vulnerable to the stimuli that lead to conditioned hypereating. But in the end, this is behavior that anyone can develop. Learning to overeat is an incremental process that grows with repeated exposure. What came first? Did changes in how, when, where, and how much we consume food lead to conditioned hypereating? Or did conditioned hypereating alter social and commercial patterns so that stimulating food became that much easier to secure? We don't know yet. In either case, a cycle has been set in motion. Ultimately, it begins to seem more surprising that some people manage to eat normally than that many do not.
Part 4. The Theory of Treatment. Chapter 36. Invitations to the Brain.
Despite the challenges, we do have opportunities to break the cue, urge, reward, habit cycle and treat conditioned hypereating. It's important to have a framework for thinking about treatment, a framework rooted in theories of how we learn and the knowledge contained in many different scientific fields. More specific treatment strategies follow in the next section, building on the theories presented here. To protect ourselves from stimuli that arouse us and drive us to act, we first need to recognize how vulnerable we are to those stimuli. In conditioned hypereating, food cues are the stimulus, overeating the habitual response. "These cues," said James Lechman, professor of child psychiatry and pediatrics in the Child Study Center at Yale University School of Medicine, "are invitations to the brain. The ability to respond to urges for food is built in, but if you give in to those urges too often, the system becomes dysregulated. Then you're hypersensitive to these cues," Lechman explained. "To control our brains, we have to be mistrustful of our brains. We have to recognize they are the vehicle to invite us to do things that at some point in our evolutionary past may have been very useful, but have gotten completely out of control." Raymond Miltenberger dramatized the extent of human vulnerability in his description of compulsive hair pulling, a stimulus response disorder that primarily afflicts girls and women. Once a hair puller grasps a single hair on her scalp, telling herself, "I can just pull one, that will be okay," she has basically lost her struggle for restraint. To cope with her affliction, she must first recognize the automaticity of her response and understand that if she pulls out a single hair, she'll pull out 20 more. Only then will she be ready to learn intervention techniques and to use them. Effective intervention draws us away from the conditioning power of a stimulus before it triggers its usual response. It reminds us that it's possible to say no. Intervention begins with the knowledge that we have a moment of choice, but only a moment, to recognize what is about to happen and do something else instead. The cornerstone of treatment for conditioned hypereating is developing the capacity to refuse the cue's invitation to the brain in the first place. That refusal must come early, and it must be definitive. It's only at the very beginning, when the invitation arises, that you have any control over it, Lechman affirmed. At that point, it's still possible to turn away from the stimulus. Once we get started, a cascade of events, stimulation, response, and more stimulation, is likely to drive behavior. If we do manage to say no, our vulnerability to the stimuli doesn't simply disappear. We never fully unlearn earlier responses. "The old habit is still there," said Mark Boughton, a professor of psychology at the University of Vermont. Boughton studies the relationships among context, conditioning, and memory, and he's helped shape current thinking about how humans can alter their behavior. "We can learn something new, but when you learn something new, you don't necessarily get rid of the old thing. Because earlier associations linger, they can all too easily surface under the right circumstances." Animal experiments have demonstrated this reaction. Rats learn to fear a tone if they're given a shock every time they hear it. The fear eases if that tone is subsequently repeated without an accompanying shock. But they don't entirely unlearn the connection. With the right manipulations, their fear can readily be rekindled. The same principle applies when we have had a positive emotional response to a stimulus. Once established, the connection between a cue and a memory is never fully severed. Many people who haven't smoked for decades still feel the urge for a cigarette at certain times. Cigarettes remain a hot stimulus with a promise of reward. Despite that legacy, new learning is possible, and most of the time it can prevent us from acting on our urges. We can practice new behaviors and learn new thoughts to keep the old ones at bay. Eventually, these can become as automatic as our past responses, and when they do, the stimulus begins to cool. Avoiding risky situations is one approach, but in a world of omnipresent food cues, in all-you-can-eat America, that isn't enough. It's simply impossible to avoid the temptation of highly palatable food all the time. To succeed, you will need to be able to employ a variety of other cognitive and behavioral tools, and then you will need to practice using them with determination and commitment until you can alter the reactions that are generated by stimulation.
Chapter 37. Reversing the Habit.
Refusing a cue's invitation to the brain means reversing long-standing habits. In the beginning, you'll need to control your actions carefully. But in the long term, you'll replace one set of automatic behaviors for another. As Raymond Miltenberger said, the new response needs to become so well entrenched and so automatic and part of your repertoire that now when you walk past tempting food, you say, "Boy, that smells good, but it's not in my plan," and you keep on walking. To do so requires repeated practice and enough behavior change to establish a track record of success. That, in turn, will reinforce your capacity to persevere. Ultimately, there must also be a motivational component to enduring change. You'll have to learn new habits that are rewarding enough to keep you from engaging in the old ones. "We're talking about something that's very difficult to do," said James Lechman, "and if you fail in some of your early attempts, or if you give a try and have only limited success, it's very easy to get discouraged and feel like it's just beyond my power and control to manage this." A sense of powerlessness is one of the biggest obstacles to success. If you feel you have no choice but to engage in a behavior, the arousal that drives it will persist. But if you develop a sense of your own capacity for control and recognize that you need not engage in habitual behavior, that sense of arousal will begin to diminish. The ability to change entrenched habits rests with you. Four major components of habit reversal grow out of the literature of behavioral and cognitive psychology and have proven effective in dealing with repetitive behaviors: awareness, competing behavior, competing thoughts, and support. A fifth, emotional learning, has not traditionally been a part of habit reversal, but it may be the missing piece for treating the most recalcitrant habits. That category certainly includes conditioned hypereating and the driven behavior that is at its core. Following the tenets of habit reversal can help you overcome conditioning and regain control of your behavior. Awareness is the first step. Being aware means that you have a conscious knowledge of the risks of a given situation. You have to figure out the situation that leads you to eat, that leads you to start the chain of behaviors, said Miltenberger. That is the absolute first step, to catalog all of the stimuli, all of the situations, all of the cues that start that chain. Lechman talked about recognizing premonitory urges, urges that foreshadow the action you automatically take. Premonitory urges are a characteristic feature of stimulus response disorders. The gate that's usually there to hold back the flood of sensory information doesn't work as well in some of these disorders, Lechman noted. More sensation makes it into the conscious awareness of vulnerable people, forcing them to confront more powerful urges. They respond with familiar and repetitive behavior that relieves those urges, at least momentarily. "This is obsessive-compulsive disease. This is Tourette's. This is life," Lechman said. By that, he meant we all respond to sensory stimuli to some degree or other, whether or not we have a diagnosable disorder. "It's not so much a question of, do you have it or not," he explained. "The question is, how much of it do you have?" Experience tells us that sensory signals, stressful situations, and forceful memories are all invitations to out-of-control eating. To have any power over those cues requires first that we notice them and know the behavior they stimulate. "Once you're cued, once you have the premonitory urge, is it too late?" I asked. "No," insisted Lechman. "That's the point at which you've got a moment of control." "It is at that moment," he explained, "that you say, 'Thank you. I'm aware of the urge, and now I have a moment of decision. Am I going to walk through that door and accept that invitation, or am I going to turn away and walk through another door?'" Becoming aware that there's a choice to be made means bringing the setting and your habitual response into conscious thought. You have to ask people to specifically pay attention so that they can begin to self-monitor, said Matthew State, professor of child psychiatry and genetics at Yale School of Medicine. Once they pay attention, they have a capacity to extinguish the behavior. The second component of habit reversal is engaging in competing behaviors. To resist what Milton Berger calls the pull of the behavior, we need to develop and learn alternative responses that are incompatible with it. Rather than coming home at night and going straight to the refrigerator, you change your routine and don't even enter the kitchen. You drive a different route to work in order to avoid the fast food corridor that tempts you, or you make a list and ask a family member to go to the grocery store so you don't risk off-limits purchases. To compete successfully with old habits, this competing behavior needs to be planned before you encounter a cue. You need to know exactly how to respond when your brain receives an unwanted invitation. You've got to be prepared with some other behavior because the closer you get to eating, the more powerful it becomes, the more reinforcing, said Milton Berger. If you intervene early and start a new chain that will prevent you from going down the other path, then you're more likely to be successful. To break the pattern of stimulus and response, you must have a roadmap to guide you through high-risk settings. Substituting competing behaviors for habitual responses demands that you use your executive control functions, which can override the more primitive, hardwired circuitry of the brain. Doing that, said Lechman, requires a lot of new learning. The third element of habit reversal is formulating thoughts that compete with and serve to quiet the old ones. I think we take for granted how much of what we do is verbally mediated, governed by talking our way through a problem, said the Canadian psychologist Philip David Zelazo. In essence, we write a cognitive script that helps us carry out new behavior and deal effectively with the old. Our thoughts, and the language we use to express them, can remind us of the consequences of bad habits, guide us to other actions, and heighten the reinforcement value of success. We can introduce ideas that countermand others. Instead of, "That pint of chocolate ice cream looks really good to me. I'll have just a few bites," we can say to ourselves, "I know that I can't have one bite because it will lead to 20. We can remind ourselves of our goals. "If I don't eat that now, I'll feel better about myself tomorrow." Or we can repeat statements of self-efficacy. "I don't have to respond that way. I can respond this way." Or, "I can do this. I can control this." Instead of responding habitually to the promise of immediate reward, we can make ourselves conscious of the long-term impact of eating highly palatable food. This shift of attention is a tool for gaining cognitive control that involves changing the way you think about the meaning of the stimulus, according to Kevin Ochsner, who studies the psychological and neural processes involved in emotion, self-regulation, and perception at Columbia University. By learning to think not only of the pleasure of a sugar cookie, but also of its direct contribution to weight gain, we can begin to seize cognitive control. Thinking about outcomes changes how you feel about the situation, Ochsner explained. By changing the way we talk to ourselves about food, we can endorse new ways of thinking and learn how to shift the meaning we assign to something we once wanted. You're providing a mental reimagining of the stimulus and using that to control your behavior, said Ochsner. The fourth component of habit reversal is support. None of these changes are easy to make, and having someone around who can help you recognize and avoid cues and acknowledge your success makes the whole process much easier. Ultimately, the choices we make are ours alone, but supportive family, friends, colleagues, and health professionals can make a big difference. People often engage in habitual behavior in private. I've got a plan, I know what I'm supposed to do, but if I'm home alone, I can easily short-circuit that plan, said Miltenberger. If I have support from a person who knows my plan and who can be there, it's more likely I'll be successful. It would be embarrassing to overeat in front of my friend or spouse to whom I just made a commitment. Support is a way of sustaining and reinforcing our motivation not to engage in conditioned hypereating, adds Miltenberger. That's how you make it more likely that you'll be able to resist the immediate, strongly reinforcing situation. Now you've got this other contingency, this person to whom you've made a commitment. It's going to be hard to break that commitment when that person is with you. Of course, you must find the right kind of support. Otherwise, your support system can work against you, endorsing the type of behavior you're trying to reverse. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that social networks can promote obesity. People with friends, siblings, and spouses who are obese are more likely to be obese themselves. If your support system does not reinforce your goals, you're better off going it alone. But the right support can make a difference. For one thing, social engagement itself can serve as a competing behavior or substitute reward. It can also reduce the anxiety that accompanies giving up old behavior and the ambivalence you may feel about saying no. And finally, the prospect of disappointing the people you care about or earning the disapproval of someone who's trying to help can keep you on track.
Chapter 38. Rules of Disengagement.
At the heart of conditioned hypereating lies the impulsive nature of the behavior. Because people with conditioned hypereating are so sensitive to food cues, they tend to make eating decisions on the spur of the moment. To compete with the chaotic nature of that behavior, we need to develop a set of rules to keep us from becoming aroused. Setting rules helps us make the steps of habit reversal real. Rules provide structure, preparing us for encounters with tempting stimuli and redirecting our attention elsewhere. As a type of top-down processing, executed with awareness, rules stand in contrast to the bottom-up, reflexive conditioning that typically dictates our response. Rules are conscious. They can be expressed in words. We can reflect on them and apply them to new situations. We know that we shouldn't eat foods rich in sugar, fat, and salt when we're trying to lose weight, just as we know we shouldn't smoke or drink to excess. But it isn't easy to act on that kind of abstract knowledge. Simply knowing the right behavior isn't enough. What we need is to develop a planned response when we encounter a stimulating food that drives conditioned hypereating. That protects you against automatic contingencies that are going to be primed all around you in the environment and that you can't control, explained Walter Michel of Columbia University's Department of Psychology, who has dedicated his career to the study of personality and self-regulation. A plan connects specific actions to specific possibilities. Preparing for situations in which we actually encounter such foods is a lot more useful than having a good idea, such as, I should stop eating high-fat foods. Concrete if-then rules can be useful and effective. The idea is to have a countermanding action for a risky situation. If I encounter this cue, then I regulate my response to it in this way. When you have those rules in mind, they can help prepare you for what you need to do, said Kevin Oxner. Once you're in the moment, experiencing the emotional force of the cue, this becomes a lot harder. Rules work in part by giving us an alternative to a conditioned response, forcing us to engage in contrary behavior that is incompatible with habitual behavior, said Matthew State of the Yale School of Medicine. When my brain receives the signal that salient foods are nearby and recalls their pleasure, I remember my rules, which tell me, don't stop, pass them by, turn your attention elsewhere. Set that rule, stick with it, and in time your desire will decrease. We have the science to demonstrate that this works. Adults who were placed on either a low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet or a low-calorie, low-fat diet did not develop cravings for the restricted food. Once the stimuli that have been paired with the food are gone, the preference for eating the food diminishes. Rules aren't the same thing as willpower. Willpower pits the force of reinforcing stimuli against your determination to resist, a clash of titans that can become very uncomfortable. What's the difference between just using willpower to resist food and having a rule? I asked Sylvia Bungie, whose research at the University of California, Berkeley, focuses on cognitive control. If you develop a rule, that will allow you to better inhibit the behavior because you'll have a context that provides some kind of reason for inhibiting in the first place, she said. A rule makes explicit the negative consequences of giving in to your impulses and the positive consequences of not giving in. Without any kind of context or motivation, there's really no reason that you would inhibit the response of wanting it. Rules are guided by higher brain functions, said Bungie, and they need to be kept in mind so that they substitute for unconscious action. There's that idea of a cognitive script again, the strategy of using words and thoughts consciously to craft a new response to habit-driven cues. The more specific the rules are, the easier it is to hold them in mind and to represent an alternative action. Categorical rules, I don't eat French fries, I will not have dessert, are the easiest to follow. With practice, new responses can eventually become as automatic as the old ones. If I'm being cued, if I'm being stressed, and that sets off my wanting, how can rules overcome all the effects of a hot stimulus? I asked Michelle. They're not going to unless they've been practiced and also made automatic, he observed. Unless your implementation plan goes from being a good idea to something that becomes an automatic behavior pattern, I don't think you get anywhere. Using an analogy to alcohol, Michelle emphasized that it's not enough for someone to say, I am dying from this addiction, so I really don't want to drink anymore. The thought alone won't make it happen. The shift from wanting to behave differently to actually doing so requires setting rules and practicing them until they become programmed behavior. The goal, Michelle said, is to create rules that pass control of the external stimuli to the self. Only then can we make the essential transition from a desire to change itself. Every time I approach the food court at the San Francisco airport, I'm tempted to stop for fried dumplings. The representation of that behavior is etched in my brain. I can see myself doing it, and I know I'll be rewarded. But an incompatible behavior, refusing temptation and walking on by, is also represented there. Those opposing representations vie with each other for dominance. It's a competition between these representations of actions, and whichever one is strongest is going to win, said Sylvia Bungie. The drive for sugar, fat, and salt tends to be the stronger representation, she notes. The salient thing, based on bottom-up drives, is to stop at the food court. That's what learning and habit dictate. That's what gets the neurons firing. That's the response that satisfies my basic desire. But to achieve other goals, like maintaining weight loss and eating healthier food, I need to behave differently. The problem is that my brain hasn't been trained to respond to the message, no, it would be better for my health and my looks if I don't do this. It is more accustomed to responding to an immediate orosensory reward. But that doesn't mean that the longer-term reward can't eventually take on more salience. That's where the prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain responsible for executive control, plays a key role, boosting the force of goals other than obtaining the reward of highly palatable foods. It literally sends excitatory inputs to the weaker representation, amping that up, causing stronger activation of those neurons, said Bungie. It can lead to an increase in activity of the neurons that is going to control your ability to walk away. In other words, the habit-driven response of stopping at the food court competes with the executive functions signaling me to walk past it. Over time, if I am successful at turning down the salience of a cue often enough, its intensity will diminish as new learning substitutes for the old. By increasing the activation of neurons that represent one behavior, keep going, the prefrontal cortex succeeds at suppressing the alternative, stop and eat. That creates an opportunity, Bunge said, for the action plan that's getting the top-down input from the prefrontal cortex to win the race. The action plan offers me a tool for refusing invitations to the brain. Experience has taught me something essential about the neuronal excitement I get as I near the food court. The urge to stop doesn't last. If I can maintain focus and repeat my rules, do not detour, go right to the baggage claim, I can redirect my attention away from the stimulus. Once I'm safely beyond its enticing call, my neurons settle down, and I'm not tempted to turn around and go back. I've accepted that those fried dumplings are unavailable to me. That's my personal experience with a broader lesson. Rules that make food unavailable can modulate how we respond to cues. The sensory signals of a piece of fried chicken don't evoke the same neural activity if we know that it is not available. A photograph of fried chicken may not activate the reward pathways to the same degree if we're on a mountaintop miles away from the nearest KFC. Alain Dauger, a neurologist at Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University, used imaging technology in a study of smokers to learn how anticipation influences brain activity. All his participants had brain scans, but only some were told in advance that they would be able to smoke immediately after the test was completed. The others understood that they couldn't have a cigarette for another 4 hours and that a carbon monoxide monitor would be used to ensure that they complied. Dauger's MRI scans showed that areas of the brain involved in arousal and attention were essentially shut down in the population that did not expect to be able to smoke afterward. We confirmed with our study that you could reduce the behavior response and the brain imaging response to cigarette cues by reducing expectancy of reward, said Dauger. Somehow, these people have the ability to suppress that response. If a reward is deemed unavailable, it affects what we thought was a very basic and automatic response. Apparently, when the brain knows that a reward will not be forthcoming, it shifts its attention elsewhere. Rules are designed to take advantage of that capacity by shutting out the possibility of pursuing a food reward and forcing us to focus on something else. Over time, it can become second nature to follow those rules. But until then, rules need to be kept in mind so that they're available to guide behavior in the moments we need them. That requires attention, practice, and advanced planning, motivated by the expectation that you will ultimately derive emotional satisfaction in new ways. Your ability to follow your own rules will eventually carry its own reward.
Chapter 39. Emotional Learning.
Learning to act in a new way requires either being drawn towards something you want or being pushed away from something that no longer seems desirable. Learning comes most readily when the two occur together. More than many habits, conditioned hypereating involves stimuli we have come to depend on for comfort. Their positive emotional charge drives our behavior. We have cultivated very positive associations with the stimuli at a gut level, said Philip David Zelazo of the University of Toronto. We can look at a piece of cherry pie, consider only one dimension of it, its appealing taste, and evaluate it as something we want. But Zelazo tells us we can also see something much more complex. There are infinite ways you can look at a piece of cherry pie. Our attention, our memories, our expectation feed into the kind of cue it becomes for us. As we become more consciously aware of those dimensions, that piece of pie can begin to look very different. To alter our behavior, we need to change our emotional appraisal of salient food. We begin that process by recognizing our capacity to assign food a value, either good or bad. If we learn to view the pursuit of sugar, fat, and salt in a negative light, and to imbue with equal emotional significance behavior that encourages us to turn away from it, we can reverse a habit. Psychologist Arnold Washington offered a vivid description of the emotional underpinnings of old habits and the challenge of mastering new learning when he related the story of a medical student who struggled with addiction. The first time the young man was caught diverting drugs at work, he was encouraged to enter rehabilitation. The second time, he was again urged to seek treatment and warned that he would be expelled from medical school if he stole drugs again. "The young man," said Washington, "will tell you that he wants nothing more in life than to finish his MD, PhD program and be a physician, that this is of the greatest value to him, that his entire self-esteem, his self-worth, rides on this." And yet the student took drugs a third time. Evidently, to him, the reinforcement value of the drugs is still far greater than the reinforcement of his career path. Changing that kind of behavior requires almost heroic effort, acknowledged Washington. "What ends up being critical is the way in which you're appraising the meaning of the stimulus," he explained. "You can move from one highly charged affective appraisal to another, from, 'That's going to be fantastic,' to, 'That's the most disgusting thing in the universe. I don't want to come near it.'" As you begin to evaluate a familiar stimulus in a new way, you protect yourself from its compelling draw. Developing negative associations, which is sometimes called counter-conditioning, has proved useful in reducing tobacco use. Over the past decade, many adults have come to view cigarettes differently, not as sexy and glamorous, but as repulsive and deadly. One colleague told me that every time he felt tempted to smoke, he put his nose into a jar packed with cigarette butts and inhaled deeply. The negative association with that act has helped him move from abstractly recognizing that he should stop smoking because it's bad for his health to a deeply felt understanding that this product is not a friend, but a detested enemy. He has acquired an emotional feeling about smoking that has him disgusted so vividly that even the thought of approaching a cigarette is aversive, explained Walter Michel. It activates negative feelings and thoughts. Presumably, his brain activity is going to steer him away from this. "We talk to patients about playing the tape until the end," said Arnold Washington. "The cognitive strategy is to become well practiced in recognizing when you're having euphoric recall and selectively remembering only the good parts. Then, in your mind, you play the scenario out to the end and you say, 'This is what's going to happen. I'll feel good for 2 minutes, and then I'll feel horrible.'" At the same time, new behavior must come to have an emotional value that carries its own rewards. Unless a person makes the cognitive shift, where it's more reinforcing to have a life without the substances than it is to have a life with them, recovery is not obtainable, said Washington. Michelle agreed. Not smoking becomes the thing that individuals feel good about. Smoking has become aversive rather than pleasurable. It may not seem that food can become as readily aversive as cigarettes, but for my part, very large portions now strike me as genuinely disgusting. And consider the burger from the Claim Jumper restaurant, which piles avocado, cheddar cheese, applewood smoked bacon, and sweet onion rings on the meat. Contemplate the real message in the attempted humor of its name, and distaste may temper desire. It's called the Widowmaker Burger. Cues to foods that are high in sugar, fat, and salt create emotional tension, a psychic itch, if you will, and eating becomes a strategy for easing the stimulus-induced tension. This becomes habit, made automatic by the repeated experience of gaining reward and the learning attached to it. Over time, those associations automatically activate a positive memory, said Russell Fazio, a professor in the psychology department at Ohio State University and an expert on the formation and evolution of human attitudes. That automatically activated positivity will be the starting point for perceptions and judgments, he said. The fact that a smoker knows cigarettes are harmful, or that the obese person understands that eating fried food contributes to her weight problem, does not necessarily interfere with that automatic response. Motivation and opportunity are required as well. If the individual is properly motivated, you can override the impact of the automatically activated attitude, but that's effortful, and it requires mental resources, explained Fazio. Many times our resources are sufficiently taxed in day-to-day life that we just can't engage in that kind of motivated overriding of our impulses. To change our associations with a stimulus, we need to make a direct attack, Fazio says, on the way we evaluate it. In his studies, Fazio exposes subjects to a visual stream of information designed to create new pairings in our minds. That's what advertising agencies do when they link an Olympic athlete to a pair of sneakers or an attractive woman to a piece of new technology. The consequence is that we actually produce a change in the automatically activated attitude, he said. People who want to curb their overeating need to make a similar shift in order to maintain self-control over the long run. The dieter who is successful eventually manages to have negativity automatically activated in response to the presence of a chocolate cake, said Fazio. How do you get to the point where the sugar isn't inherently reinforcing? I asked. It's a matter of how we construe the object, Fazio explained. Everybody knows that chocolate cake is high in calories and should be avoided if you're on a diet. The idea is to have that construal dominate over the other possible construal as a treat. The goal is to extinguish the learned associations that encourage us to pursue reward in the form of sugar, fat, and salt, and instead to develop new associations that turn us away from them. The experts make this point in many different ways. James Lechman describes it as a way of refusing invitations to the brain. Behavioral psychologists use the term counterconditioning, and Kevin Ochsner talks about the process of changing the way we appraise a stimulus. Washington focuses on the need to make a cognitive paradigm shift, and in the annals of psychology, the concept is known as making a critical perceptual shift. It all means essentially the same thing, looking at a stimulus in new ways. How we make that shift will vary from individual to individual. For me, it was about altering my perceptions of large portions. Once, I thought a big plate of food was what I wanted and needed to feel better. Now, I see that plate for what it is. Layers of fat on fat on sugar on fat that will never provide lasting satisfaction and only keep me coming back for more. With that critical perceptual shift, large portions look very different to me. I have changed the reward value of the stimulus. To build on this information and treat conditioned hypereating, we need to understand two key principles and how they're linked. As we've seen, cue-induced behavior is automatic behavior. Once the association between food cues and emotional reward has become embedded in the brain, highly rewarding food steals our attention. Second, our perception of a food stimulus directly influences our behavior in response to it. If we think rewarding food is a friend, we're likely to pursue it. If we think it's an enemy, we'll turn from it with distaste. At first blush, those principles appear somewhat contradictory. If behavior is automatic, why does our view of the stimulus matter? The answer is that managing our eating behavior depends on our ability to alter automatic responses to food cues and gain conscious control over them. We do that most effectively by engaging the higher functions of the brain to change our perceptions. In the presence of a stimulus, conditioned hypereaters tend to engage the higher brain regions in less than useful ways. Sometimes we formulate rationalizations that allow us to act on our desire for reward. Thoughts like, I deserve this, or I'll only have a small piece, are strategies for easing our discomfort about behavior we know is not in line with our goals. And sometimes we use higher brain functions to engage in an internal debate about the pros and cons of a food choice, telling ourselves, this would taste good, but I know I shouldn't eat it, is an attempt to gain control, although it does carry the risk of backfiring if you become too preoccupied with the stimulus. There's another, more productive way to use the brain's executive functions, by formulating strong opinions about the stimulus. When you perceive hyperpalatable food as negative, and place that recognition in your working memory so you can access it quickly, you're better equipped to interfere with the automatic response and make healthier food choices. Effective treatment of conditioned hypereating is dependent upon making that perceptual shift and learning new behavior that eventually becomes as rewarding as the old.
Part 5. Food Rehab. Chapter 40. The Treatment Framework.
The nation's weight problem is evidence, in part, that we have gotten a lot of bad advice. New diets are constantly being developed and marketed to help us change our behavior, our thought processes, our emotions, or the food combinations we put on our plates. Although some of these programs do help us shed pounds, none of them have allowed us to keep weight off over the long haul. What's missing has been an understanding of how we lost control over eating in the first place and how we can use that knowledge to our advantage. The nature of the problem, our focus on food as a reward, suggests the solution. It is time to begin thinking about food rehab. Readjusting your expectations about food requires gaining new perspective. My own perspective shifted as I worked on this book. I described a meal I had recently eaten at a San Francisco restaurant to a woman regarded as one of the top food coaches in the country. I thought my dinner had been about the right size, and I felt pleased that I'd skipped dessert. But when I described exactly what I had eaten as an appetizer and a main course, she was blunt in her assessment. "You just ate twice as much as you needed," she said. I was stunned. In that moment, I realized I had lost track of what I needed to feel satisfied. Since then, I've worked hard to figure it out, and I've learned to find reward in smaller amounts of foods I enjoy. Over time, doing that has gotten much easier. In fact, gaining a sense of control has become its own reward. I no longer need to derive quite so much of my satisfaction from sugar, fat, and salt. Food rehab is the key to viewing food stimuli in new ways. Once we decide to seek reward from avenues other than endless quantities of hyperpalatable foods, we can begin to restructure our environment and strengthen our behavior to support new learning and the pursuit of new rewards. A few essential principles lie at the foundation of food rehab. Conditioned hypereating is a biological challenge, not a character flaw. Recovery is impossible until we stop viewing overeating as an absence of willpower. Treating conditioned hypereating means recognizing it as a chronic problem that needs to be managed, not one that can be completely cured. Every time we act on our desire for sugar, fat, and salt and earn a reward as a result, it becomes harder for us to act differently the next time. Effective treatment breaks the cue, urge, reward, habit cycle at the core of conditioned hypereating. The loss of control that characterizes conditioned hypereating is magnified by diets that leave us feeling deprived. New learning can stick only when it generates a feeling of satisfaction. We can't sustain a change in behavior if it leaves us hungry, unhappy, angry, or resentful. Restoring control over eating requires us to take a comprehensive approach, one that has many interlocking steps. To gain the upper hand, we need strategies that address the multiple behavioral, cognitive, and nutritional elements of conditioned hypereating. Lapses are to be expected. Most of us are never fully cured of conditioned hypereating. We remain vulnerable to the pull of old habits, although with time and the rewards that accompany success, they do lose some of their power. With practice, we can find ways to use slips to our advantage as tools for recognizing where we might stumble and reminders of the need to develop new learning. Eventually, we can begin to think differently about food, recognizing its value to sustain us and protect us from hunger and denying it the authority to govern our lives. The elements of the food rehab program outlined here have been used and tested in other contexts and still need to be rigorously evaluated for the treatment of conditioned hypereating. Nonetheless, I believe they can offer you some help. To change the way you eat, you'll need to focus on how you approach food, craft a plan to which you can devote concentrated attention, and recognize that making progress is incremental and effortful. The suggestions presented here are very practical and very forgiving. they recognize that it won't be easy to change your habits. Situations will arise when the old reward value of food is almost impossible to resist. This isn't a sign of failure, but simply a reminder that it's difficult to unlearn old behavior. I don't offer a one-size-fits-all technique, because I know it will not work. New learning that sticks is new learning that resonates for you. It takes individual experimentation to determine how you can structure your environment and strengthen your behavior. The idea is to mix and match the tools presented here and to find the ones that work best for you.
Chapter 41. Planned Eating.
As we've discussed, treating conditioned hypereating means, in part, developing new eating behaviors to compete with the old ones. Think of this approach as planned eating, which is rooted in clinically proven techniques of behavior modification and built on four elements: replacing chaos with structure, just right eating, choosing foods that satisfy you, and eating foods you enjoy. Together, this package deconditions your habitual response to highly palatable food and its cues and gives you a specific alternative behavior to substitute. In time, planned eating can recondition your behavior. The trick is to identify foods that you can learn to eat in a controlled way and that are at least as reinforcing as the foods you once overate. The first element, replacing chaos with structure. Planned eating calls upon you to replace chaos with structure. This structure is designed to keep you away from salient stimuli in the environment, protect you from cues, and curb the impulsive behavior that drives you toward reward. It tells you what is permissible and what is not, taking away the need for you to make decisions about food in vulnerable moments. It gives you competing and repeatable behaviors that guide you past temptation and toward foods that satisfy. It allows you to set up a parallel food universe while continuing to participate in normal social and work activities. The rules that support your structure must be simple enough to fit with your busy life, but specific enough to remove uncertainty from the food equation. Instead of facing a day filled with the unplanned eating opportunities that drive out-of-control behavior, you must develop a set of meal plans and a repertoire of satisfying foods. Those meals should offer sufficient variety to keep you interested, but enough predictability that you can avoid being stimulated and don't have to make continuous decisions about what to eat. That kind of predictability is the secret behind meal replacements, those all-in-one powders, shakes, and packaged foods that promote weight loss so effectively. The unyielding structure of meal replacements inhibits the mindless and repetitive eating that takes place in a world without boundaries. But this works only for short periods of time. You probably can't tolerate meal replacements for long and still participate in the business and social activities that fill most of our lives. Structure offers a more lasting approach, allowing you to function in the real world so you can still enjoy restaurants and the company of the friends and family who invite you to join them for dinner. At first, structure is imposed from the outside, with meal plans that tell you what you can eat, when, and how much. You determine in advance what you'll put on your plate at mealtimes and for snacks, you write out your menus, and you block out everything else. One overarching and rigid rule will be your guide. If it isn't part of your structure, you don't eat it. The idea is to eliminate your mental tug of war. When you first begin to practice this, there's no room for deviation. You need to ease the tension of temptation, to quiet the warring voices that say, "I want that food. I shouldn't have that food. I'm going to eat that food." But over time, that can change. Once you've established new patterns and reconditioned yourself to non-chaotic eating, you'll be able to open the door to other foods. There's no real timetable, but as you learn to protect yourself from hunger and realize that small amounts of food can be satisfying, you will begin to feel more comfortable adding some flexibility to your meals. As you master the art of portion control, establish new habits, and realize that the triggers of overeating are beginning to lose some of their power, you may be able to end the total ban on foods high in sugar, fat, and salt. If you adore hamburgers, you'll eventually be able to structure meal plans that allow you to eat hamburgers. Not monstrous burgers layered with cheese and bacon, but good-tasting hamburgers all the same. Few foods will be totally out of bounds. You'll be able to enjoy the pleasure of food without feeling the guilt of overindulgence. The next element, just right eating. Planned eating means choosing food in appropriate quantities, figuring out how much you should put on your plate so you feel satisfied until it's time to eat again. For most people, a just right meal is one that will keep away hunger for about 4 hours. A just right snack should keep you satisfied for about 2 hours. It's important to think in advance about what a meal or snack should look like, and then to put only that much on your plate. Feedback signals from the stomach come long after you have consumed too much, and the increased activity of the brain makes it difficult for people with conditioned hypereating to stop eating if there's more food in front of them. Serving yourself just right meals is an automatic safeguard against the habit of going back mindlessly for more. People with conditioned hypereating tend to overestimate how much food they need to hold them comfortably until it's time to eat again. That's why I was so startled by the food coach who told me I'd eaten 2 meals at one sitting. When your plan is built around just right eating, this doesn't happen. A useful way to gauge what will truly satisfy you is to eat only half of your usual meal. Then pay attention to how you feel 30 minutes later, and 90 minutes after that. If you're experiencing real hunger, try the same experiment again with 3/4 of your standard portion. Chances are good that you'll find one of those servings to be enough. Beyond that, you're eating for reward, not satiety. It often comes as quite a shock to realize how much less you can eat. Some people count calories because they find it the easiest way to know how much they're eating. Others are willing to weigh their food to determine portion size. But those strategies are impractical for most of us because they take too much time and are too difficult to do. A better approach is to develop an intuitive sense of how much you need to feel satisfied. By paying close attention to how much food you eat and how long it sustains you, you learn that portions smaller than you've come to expect will hold you perfectly well. There is a strong cognitive element to this process. What I perceive to be satisfying will help me determine whether it actually is. If you say, "I'm going to be hungry after I eat that," or "that won't be enough," when you're served a plate of food, then you'll probably want more. But if you believe the food in front of you will fill you up, it's likely to do so. Patricia Pliner, a professor of social psychology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, has demonstrated that if people feel they've been served a meal, they